You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as Fork in the Road, Small Things Often, and Therapist Uncensored. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. This week, Karen and I are both traveling, and I needed to give you something to listen to, so I thought I'd pull out a sample episode from our Patreon bonus series, Big Footage. This is a special series I created for our patrons as a thank you for their kind support. There's more than 200 Bigfoot movies, and that number keeps growing every year as the hairy guy's cultural ubiquity and public domain availability make it perfect for low-budget horror and pseudo-documentaries. In this episode, we're going to be looking at the 1975 feature, Sasquatch: The Legend of Bigfoot. This movie has a couple of historical distinctions. For one, it's the closest thing to the film that Roger Patterson wanted to make, following much of the content and use of Bigfoot Hunt as a framing story. Second, it's the only Bigfoot movie I saw on the big screen back in the 1970s. I mean, sure, I saw Boggy Creek and I saw Black Lake, but not on the big screen. And looking back at the dates, it seems that I let this series slip into hiatus during the pandemic, and despite continuing to watch movies and take notes, I haven't quite had the gumption to get any more of these out the door, and that's been haunting me. And y'all know I cannot stand to be haunted. So the cure, I think, is to shake the dust off this series, give our non-patron audience a taste of what these are like, and pledge to get back in the saddle and make more of these for you in the hope that it might be enough to get a few more people to sign up for Patreon support. For just $3 a month, you get longer episodes, bonus content like Big Footage, and access to episodes earlier than our ad-supported free feed. But enough blabbering about how much we need your support. Let's get that popcorn going and have ourselves some
Monster Talk.
July 1960. While flying over a remote section of northern Canada, a Canadian aircraft patrol pilot suddenly encountered the huge shape of a strange unknown giant. But what was it? And where did it come from? Now comes a motion picture that explores this incredible mystery. Don't miss Sasquatch, rated G.
Now showing at the Embassy, 46th Street.
Big Footage.
Welcome to Big Footage, a Patreon bonus project for Monster Talk. I'm Blake Smith. In this series, I'm tackling some of the more than 200 Bigfoot movies that have been made and continue to be made. The early 1970s were an amazing time for independent movie makers, and 1972's The Legend of Boggy Creek had established that, properly marketed and distributed, there were millions of dollars to be made in bringing our big hairy pal to the cinema. When I started this series, I was just going to review whatever Bigfoot movies captured my fancy, and indeed that's been the approach that I prefer. But there is some interesting history going on that is directly relevant to our modern conception of Bigfoot today. I realized that when watching this movie, there's something complicated and maybe even important to understanding the whole field of Bigfoot going on. That research delayed me for a couple weeks getting this episode written, so I've decided to take those findings out and make them part of a regular episode. But the research involves the relationship between this movie, several other Bigfoot movies, including the famous Patterson-Gimlin film. But for now, let's get the show started. Today's entry is the 1976 film Sasquatch: The Legend of Bigfoot. This film has a personal distinction for me in that it's the only Bigfoot movie I recall ever seeing in theaters in the 1970s. And I remember this one quite well. Since I had discovered the Bigfoot books in our school library, I was fascinated and terrified by the idea of the creature. Frankly, in my brain, the night skies were full of UFOs, and the smallest cluster of pine trees probably hid some Bigfoot. Rewatching this film for this review shocked me at how much of the thing I clearly remembered. Here was an amazing collection of skilled researchers entering the most remote forests of Canada to take the most serious scientific look at Bigfoot ever, and the team would use computers and helicopters and plaster and tape recorders to find proof of the creature, including the authentic haunting cry of this magnificent animal. For clarity, I should stress that this episode's covering Sasquatch: The Legend of Bigfoot, and not the confusingly similarly titled The Legend of Bigfoot from the same year by the infamous Bigfoot hoaxer and enthusiast Ivan Marks. I'm sure we'll get to his film in time, but that movie's a real stinker, and this ain't that. Also, you know how they have those notices at the end of the movies that say, "No animals were harmed during the making of this film"? Well, yeah, you're not going to see that on this movie because animals were definitely harmed during the making of this film. So if seeing animals fighting each other or being shot and killed is troubling to you, then you might want to skip this movie. Anyway, it's all compelling stuff, except that literally none of what's presented in this film is what it seems. This isn't a documentary at all. It's all a fictionalized presentation of what an ideal Bigfoot expedition would look like. And all of that is really just framing the structure for a nested anthology of Bigfoot stories, including the Ape Canyon story and the Teddy Roosevelt story, before ending up in an exciting Bigfoot confrontation. I can't remember now if I was fooled or not. Did I have the discernment as an 8 or 9 year old to understand what fictionalized docudramas were? I don't know. But I can tell you this film is probably going to split audiences. If you're interested in the history of Bigfoot as a cultural phenomenon, you'll probably love this movie. It tells classic scary Bigfoot legends at the same time as telling about a Bigfoot expedition that would be exactly the kind of thing any Bigfoot-loving kid would have loved to have tagged along on. But if you're expecting a horror movie, there are tense moments, but this feels much more like a family-focused, G-rated nature movie that so many of the 1970s independent filmmakers tried. I'm not going to dwell on the disparity between what I remember from watching this as a kid and what I notice now, but I am confessing that I have a soft spot for this strange movie, despite its confusing mixture of the real and the fake. And again, there's more to this mixture of real and fake than you might suspect by just watching the film, but that's a deep dive I'm definitely going to have to spend time on in another episode. This movie opens with beautiful footage of the wilderness, plus creepy music. There's mountain lions and cougars and bears.
Oh my!
And coyotes and moose and deer. And then we get our Sasquatch eye view of the woods, and the soundtrack does this. And it's going to do that a lot because this movie's released in 1976, and you can absolutely tell the filmmakers have been influenced by the film Jaws. Effectively, this sound becomes a kind of operatic leitmotif for Bigfoot within the film. I've probably mentioned it before, but one other running theme in these 1970s Bigfoot movies is that they usually have some horrific earworm tune that they'll subject you to. Boggy Creek has the famous Travis Crabtree song buried in it like a music video. I have to wonder if this was because of films like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, both of which featured that same sort of music video interlude stuck right in the middle of the movie. Regardless of its sourcing, the music in Sasquatch : The Legend of Bigfoot is actually well done, if a bit repetitive. And while it does tease a sappy ballad throughout the film, you don't get the lyrics for High in the Mountains until the end credits. And by that time, you're already kind of humming it against your will. These kinds of independent movies were released through a carefully managed process called four-walling, a system by which the distributors would rent a theater and plaster or town with promotional ads, and then the ticket sales would all go to the distributors. This process was brilliantly explained in the recent biopic of Rudy Ray Moore starring Eddie Murphy called Dolomite Is My Name. Let's take a listen.
Now, we don't have a midnight movie on Friday, so I suppose we could do it then. That's $500, son.
That sounds fair. Perfect. So, when can I receive my advance?
What? Advance?
The money. When are you going to pay me?
No. See, this is what they call four-walling. Yeah, you pay me, and then you get all the ticket sales. Well, we did it with Billy Jack, and I think we even did it with Grizzly Adams. Man, you can clean up if you're successful.
So I got to pay to show my movie? Well, goddamn, am I going to get some of the popcorn money?
Oh, that's mine. But you get all the box office. Now, if you promote the shit out the movie, well, you can make some serious bread.
In addition to the movie itself, Sasquatch : The Legend of Bigfoot also offered additional merchandise. In some markets, they sold these in the lobby, and in others, they offered mail-away offers for postcard images of Bigfoot from the Patterson-Gimlin movie, and a companion audio record of the soundtrack, which included the haunting cry of Bigfoot as well as the songs. One of the books I used for reference in doing this series is a book called Bigfoot Cinema by David Coleman. I highly recommend it. Here's what Coleman has to say about the music in this movie. For lucky attendees smart enough to purchase it, the producers of Sasquatch: The Legend of Bigfoot sold a promotional 45 RPM sized, but actually 33 RPM recording, soundtrack in theater lobbies. This rare collectible features the musical cues on the A-side and weird Sasquatch howls on the B-side. It's a perennially sought-after item on eBay and other collector websites, which is a testament to how dramatically it impacted the youngsters who vividly recall to this day how many sleepless nights they endured because of the score's menacing sense of impending doom. In a genre such as Ciné du Sasquatch, where the musical scores are often indistinguishable from one another, or simply library music cues, Sasquatch: The Legend of Bigfoot enjoys a distinctive position as having one of the most effective soundtracks ever created for a cryptid film. Even the ending theme song, High in the Mountains, which despite its 1970s time frame is not a marijuana reference, has a catchy pop sensibility that captures the Last of the Mohicans feeling so prevalent in the best entries of Ciné du Sasquatch. The music was done by Al Capps, who also did movie music for other films, including Burt Reynolds' flicks such as Stroker Ace, Cannonball Run, and Sharky's Machine. Capps also co-wrote the Cher song Half-Breed with lyricist Mary Dean. But it isn't just the soundtrack that sets this film apart. The movie opens with news clips flying around on the screen and includes the famous Patterson-Gimlin footage.
The most significant find to date is the famous Roger Patterson film, taken in 1967. Patterson searched for Sasquatch for years. On October 20th, 1967, near Bluff Creek in Northern California, he encountered the creature and took these 16-millimeter pictures. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic. The first pictures ever taken of a Sasquatch.
The movie then brings us what's often missing in 1970s Bigfoot documentaries, giant IBM punch card computers.
Under the supervision of North American Wildlife Research Center, investigators began feeding data into computers. After months of computerized research on behavioral patterns, migratory movement, and eyewitness descriptions, the computer began answering the many questions surrounding these mysterious creatures. By programming information from hundreds of sightings, the computer drew us a picture of Bigfoot. It corresponded with the Patterson film. Researchers have believed that in some remote wilderness where man has never been, these creatures are living in complete solitude. The computers have now pinpointed this area, and here at North American Wildlife Research, we have organized and financed an expedition to search this unexplored area in hopes of capturing a Sasquatch.
I've probably mentioned my affinity for old computer tech before, but it was surprising for me to see a line plotter in a 1976 movie. This is a CalComp 763. Even more surprising was finding out that these plotters had been around since 1968. Amusingly, this printer makes a crude line drawing of Bigfoot, as the narrator says that the details are assembled from Bigfoot reports. And I think the implication is that the computer is confirming the reality of the Patterson film by drawing a coloring book quality print of Bigfoot. I'll put a picture of that in the show notes. Thanks to this computer analysis, the team will be going north of the Pecoteau River in British Columbia, along with cameras, sniper scope, tranquilizer guns, and a ragtag band of wilderness experts, scientists, and comic relief coots and cooks. The plan is to tranquilize Bigfoot and implant a radio tracking device so they can study the creature's habits.
The final destination of this expedition is north of the river the Indians call the Pecoteau, in a primitive part of northern British Columbia.
This was the point in my research for the episode when I realized that what I was watching was not what it seemed. There is no Pecoteau River, nor is this film made in British Columbia. It's actually filmed in Oregon. The narrator says that the research is being done under the direction of the North American Wildlife Research Center, which sounds suspiciously like the real-life North American Wildlife Research Team, which was a real group of Bigfoot researchers that operated in Oregon, and they were the creators of a large Bigfoot trap, which still stands today and is preserved by the National Park Service. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. A little after the 7-minute mark, the narration in the film changes, and we're now being told the story of the expedition through the voice and perspective of the leader of the party. I say party because for some reason, this team reminds me of a role-playing group. And let me tell you about our band of adventurers. We've got Chuck Evans, the rugged, bearded leader. I think he's probably a fighter class. We've got Josh Bigsby, the cantankerous old mountain man who uses a mule instead of a horse. He also sings. He's definitely the party's bard. Dr. Paul Markham, a goateed anthropologist with an unmistakable J. Allen Hynek look to him. They don't say it, but I'm pretty sure he's the party's magic user. Bob Vernon, the jaded New York reporter who thinks the whole thing's a waste of time. He's cynical, sarcastic, definitely a rogue. Hank Parshall, a rancher and tracking dog wrangler. Or as we would say in the RPG world, he's a ranger. And then we've got Barry Snipe. He's the cook, and he's the obligatory comic relief. I'm not sure what class he would be. He's one of those characters that's silly, yet somehow in combat turns out to be incredibly useful. I think he must be what they would call in the Pathfinder system, an expert. Which I guess means, sorry Barry, you're an NPC. And finally, we have Tekka Blackhawk, the Native American tracker who's attuned to the spirit of the land. He's definitely our party's shaman. So this is the team that will be crossing the Pecoteau River into the sacred valley of Bigfoot. But before they get there, we're going to have to look at a lot of wildlife footage.
Josh, show us where we're headed.
You see that third range of mountains over there?
Yeah.
Well, just behind that is the Pecatoe. And just beyond that is the land the Indians call Hiya Country, or Forbidden Land. You can't see those mountains from here, but they're there. And so's the critter.
While the footage of the countryside is gorgeous, and I mean that, it's really beautiful, watching people riding horses through it can get a little tedious. Fortunately, that's why game masters have random encounter tables.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Everybody, shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
If you're troubled by watching animals being harmed, you might want to skip ahead when you get to the 24-minute mark. Just hop on over to the 28-minute mark, and you'll be able to avoid the segment of the film where German shepherds confront a mountain lion, and suddenly Barney the Cook comes out of nowhere with a high-powered rifle and kills the big cat.
Good shot, Barney!
I say this not because it's graphic or excessively cruel, but because it certainly appears that it was cheaper to just shoot a real mountain lion than to use a stuffed one or a trained one. It's economical, but while I can certainly justify self-defense as a reason to shoot a mountain lion, this contrived scene just feels cruel to me. Maybe there's more to this story than I know, but if this kind of thing bothers you, just skip from the 24-minute to the 28-minute mark, and I don't think the film's plot suffers much. As I mentioned, a lot of this film is a framing story around Bigfoot reenactments. So, around the half-hour mark, we get our first flashback. As the party rests around the fire, the bard comes out with some Bigfoot stories.
Do you believe in that Mount St. Helens story?
I sure do. I knowed old Fred Beck who told me about it. The way old Beck told it to me, he and three other fellers was working a mine back in 1924 called the Vanderweyck Mine.
So here we get a very dramatic retelling of the Ape Canyon Bigfoot attack. If you listen to my other podcast, In Research Of, you'll have heard extensive coverage of this case as we dug into the popular Bigfoot episode of the TV show In Search Of, hosted by Leonard Nimoy. This dramatic retelling has lots more of that Jaws-style Bigfoot music, has Sasquatch POV, and cabin assault by rocks and hairy arms. Shadowy silhouettes of ape-like creatures throwing rocks and miners desperately firing through log cabin walls make for one of the more exciting segments in the film. The old mule packer, Josh Bigsby, really does play a lot like the Mad Jack character from the movie and TV series Grizzly Adams. In that series, character actor Denver Pyle plays an old miner with a mule who helps the greenhorn Grizzly Adams survive in the rural mountains. That film was made by Sun Classic Films in Salt Lake City and was no doubt an influence on the Salt Lake City team behind this film. Wholesome, paranormal adjacent cinema seems to be a mainstay of the Salt Lake City movie industry in the 1970s. As the film continues to chronicle the party's trek towards the Pecoteau River, the random encounter table rolls up numerous run-ins with animal stock footage. From silly otters to rampaging grizzly bears, nobody gets any experience points, but they do make it to the mighty Pecoteau River by the 45-minute mark of the film. And even though Barry Snipe is shown to be a dead shot during our mountain lion encounter, he's absolutely the film's comic relief. That even includes having his own goofy musical cue when he has to match wits with a determined badger that wants to steal the party supplies. Then it's time for another classic Bigfoot story, this time the tale that's often called the Teddy Roosevelt Bigfoot story. It's a recounting of the tale of two trackers who run into a mysterious monster that kills intruders. It's a classic by-the-campfire scary story, and the reenactment is suspenseful without being gory.
Everything was quiet. You hollered for Jessup. There was no answer. Then around the tough side of his frame. He was dead. His neck broke just like it'd been nothing but a twig.
Now, there is one bit of the movie I should also warn sensitive viewers about. For much of the trip, the team's been talking about the supply drop they're expecting. Remember, they're allegedly in a rarely visited territory which is sacred to native tribes, but which also has lots of weird Bigfoot sightings. And that strange mixture of nobody goes here and people report lots of Bigfoot stuff, that's a paradox that's not actually explored. But anyway, the team is waiting for letters and more food, and perhaps most near and dear to me and Barry Snipe, a fresh resupply of Tabasco sauce. Well, friends, to see that broken bottle of Tabasco was absolutely tragic, especially since I know if these people were willing to kill a real mountain lion, they're definitely open to just literally throwing away a bottle of precious Tabasco sauce. After this tragedy, the team still manages to cross the raging Pecoteau River and make it into the Valley of the Sasquatch. Their first night in, the New York reporter Bob Vernon gets attacked, and we're thinking it's going to be a Bigfoot, but it actually turns out to be a grizzly bear attacking him. Fortunately, he manages to survive the experience, and old Josh sews him up, and everybody's uptight after the grizzly attack.
The experience with the grizzly was pretty scary to all of us. And as Josh had warned us weeks earlier, the grizzly is the most dangerous of all big game. Vernon didn't talk much about it. His carelessness had just about cost him his life. And now he would have respect for the wilderness.
But now they're definitely in Bigfoot country, and the Squatch stalk the party through the night as they camp in Bigfoot Valley. Tracks are everywhere. Tension rises. After a few days, they come to yet another valley and find signs of trees broken halfway up. Many believe this is a Squatch warning sign that people should stay away.
What you guys have to find for?
Yes. That's the way the Sasquatch marks the outer perimeter of his domain. It's incredible. Incredible.
It is as the ancient ones have said. The Sasquatch are in the place of the three valleys. From here we go with danger.
Broken trees at that height indicated a creature that could stand over 10 feet tall and weigh better than 1,000 pounds. It was a frightening realization. The tremendous strength it would have taken to break those trees off so cleanly. And I think we all begin to understand the danger we were in.
Now that they're deep in Squatchy Valley, the team sets up the camp with tripwire sensors and all kinds of preparations for nighttime attacks. They've set up multiple perimeters around the camp with light sensors and with their back to a lake. The lights correspond to a map which will indicate anywhere a sensor is tripped. And they're also armed with the most potent tranquilizer known to man, plus sniper scopes. They are ready for attack.
We wanted to make a capture, but if things got out of hand, we would have to protect ourselves.
Now we're here for the big conclusion. That night, they're all on alert, and the Sasquatch come in heaps. There's lots of them. They throw huge logs and rocks and boulders. A Squatch boldly goes into the camp and flips over the gaming table. The sensor table. Equipment is thrown. Tents are destroyed. Darts are fired. There's boulders. There's smoke. More rocks. More trees. Chaos. Screams. It's all very Squatchy. The next morning, with the camp in ruins, I think Tekka Blackhawk sums it up.
It is done. We can go home.
And it was over. The Sasquatch didn't return.
There's just time for one more final button as they pack up and leave.
Barney? A good cup of coffee.
Wait a minute. This is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
And with that, we finally hear the lyrics to the song that's been playing throughout the entire film.
And next spring, when the snows begin to melt in the high country and the Sasquatch return, we might be here too, in the forbidden valleys of the Bigfoot, tracking and studying mankind's greatest mystery.
High in the mountains, there lives a legend few people have seen. High in the mountains, strong as the river, proud as the eagle.
And that's the conclusion of Sasquatch Calling, the Legend of Bigfoot. I found a contemporary review of the movie, which I've put in the show notes. In one paragraph, the reviewer Jim Wright says of the film, "Sasquatch is so preposterous, so inane, that gullible children and dedicated followers of camp entertainment are probably the only people who will find this movie worth the admission price."
I resemble that remark.
The biggest joke of all, however, is the box office poster that claims the movie is the most complete and only true story of Bigfoot ever filmed. Okay, well, that's a bit of a stretch. I'll give him that. The film was directed by Ed Bagozzini. The script was written by Ed Hawkins. None of the party play themselves. They're all actually actors. Some seem to be stretching further than others in their efforts, but we've got George Lawrence playing Chuck Evans, Steve Borgadine playing Hank Parshall, Jim Bradford playing Barry Snipe, Ken Kinzel playing Joss Bigsby, William Emmons playing Dr. Paul Markham, Lou Salerni playing Bob Vernon, and Joel Morello playing Tekka Blackhawk. Casting Italian Joel Morello as the Native American Tekka Blackhawk reminds me of the work of the famous 1970s crying Indian anti-pollution campaign featuring actor Iron Eyes Cody, who was also Italian. The film is based on a story by Ronald Olson, and despite the efforts to appear as a real documentary, the film doesn't have one of those based on a true events labels slapped on it, and clearly lists all of the people as actors in the end of the film. All in all, I have to tell you that Sasquatch Calling, the Legend of Bigfoot does a better job of telling the true story of Bigfoot than you might imagine, but that's a story I'll have to explain in a future episode. As for now, I want to thank you for listening to Big Footage, a Patreon bonus series. Your support makes these fascinating deep dives possible for me and also lets me financially justify what my wife might otherwise call wasting time watching crappy Bigfoot movies. And for that, I thank you all.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard a preview of our Patreon-only series, Big Footage. If you enjoyed it, I hope you'll consider going over to patreon.com/monstertalk and signing up to support us for $3 a month or more if you're feeling generous. If we can get our patronage up a little higher, I will do my best to try and deliver one of these every month. Right now, we have about 1% of our audience pledging to support us on Patreon. If we could get that number just up to 2%, it would be transformative for Karen and myself. So I hope you'll consider it. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for giving this special episode a listen.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it. Write for Pollution Booklet, Box 1771, Radio City Station, New York.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.